This is Wade Rathke. That means it's Wade's World. We're broadcasting today at 100,000 watts of people power at KABF 88.3 from Little Rock, Arkansas, but also rebroadcast in Bengaluru, Bristol, Flagstaff, Arizona, New Orleans, points here and there and long beyond. We're also webcasting at www.kabf.org if you're listening that way. The podcast on this show will be available on Monday. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to clinical professor of law at Loyola University Law School, Emily Benfer, who's also the director of the Health Justice Project there. Emily, welcome to Wade's World.
Good morning, Wade. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So we're reading and hearing, as we should be, about lead all the time now. This is not a new problem, but one that's in the news. But first, tell me, what is the Health Justice Project at Loyola? How did you get involved in all this?
I founded the Health Justice Project in 2010. I was asked to create a law school clinic designed to train the future generation of stewards of public health and law in interprofessional advocacy and lawyering skills. And so I partnered with the Erie Family Health Center, which is a federally qualified health center in Chicago, serving approximately 60,000 low-income individuals. And together, between Loyola Law School and Erie, we work to overcome the social issues that cause health problems.
Well, at least they didn't give you a small job, did they, Emily?
Right.
Wow. Okay. So with that large a constituency of lower income clients, it probably wasn't long before you started hearing about health.
Absolutely. Every single client that was referred to us, and there have been over 3,000 cases that we've worked on, had some situation in their life that directly impacted their health outcomes. And lead poisoning was a big majority of those cases.
Now, lead poisoning, just for background, that's something that, you know, they outlawed ethanol and lead and gasoline a long time ago. Supposedly, we don't have it in paint for the last almost generation, but it continues to be a devastating problem.
It's absolutely a problem today. And the reason for this, there's a long history. We've known as early as 2000 BC that lead was hazardous and a neurotoxin to humans. And in the early 1900s, up to 70% of a can of paint was leaded. In fact, just last week, I was looking at an old Dutch Boy paint can, and the contents said 99% lead.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you imagine?
No, I really can't. I remember what those little Dutch Boys looked like, and I don't think they'd look like that if it had been near that paint.
Absolutely not. They would have very severe health outcomes. And in fact, this paint was aggressively marketed to families. The slogan for Dutch Boy was, "This famous Dutch Boy lead of mine can make this playroom shine."
Okay. And now we still have those impacts.
We do. We're seeing that today. And the reason for that is that the majority of the housing stock is very old. For example, the majority of homes built before 1980 have lead-based paint somewhere in the home, and homes built before 1940 have three times as much lead-based paint as do those built between 1960 and 1979. And the other issue, too, is that lead paint was only banned in 1978 from residential use. It was not banned from industrial use.
Oh, nor marine, I know. I think lead is still in marine paint, isn't it?
It's in marine paint. It's used in buildings, in workplaces, in towers and bridges around the community.
And I don't even want to get off the subject and mention I work in a number of Latin American countries, and we found them, you know, 5 years ago when we were looking at this question, Emily, still manufacturing residential paint used on children's toys or whatever, in both Peru and Argentina. Takes your breath away. I mean, 78 to now, I mean, it's still a problem. But so recently, looking at this issue of lead in residential housing stock, you and your clinic and others, you've got quite a large coalition together. And what did you try to do?
Well, working with the providers at Erie Family Health Center, we train them to identify some of the social issues that result in poor health outcomes for their patients, and lead being one of them. So when Martha Glenn, a nurse practitioner at Erie, recognized that multiple children in one family had elevated blood lead levels, she immediately referred them to the law students in the Health Justice Project for representation. And what we learned was that Ms. Walker and her nine children all had evidence of lead poisoning in their bloodstream. This family lived in a unit that was funded by the United States Housing and Urban Development Office and was administered by the Chicago Housing Authority. So this unit that caused lead poisoning in the entire family and very high levels in the youngest three children was subsidized with taxpayer dollars.
And I think that's an important point. I mean, a lot of people, if they saw this article about what HUD standards were, and we're going to get to those standards, might have thought, oh, that's just public housing, so whatever. But we're not talking about public housing. We're talking about millions of houses, because anywhere a Section 8 voucher might have been issued and you're in a private landlord's residence, if there wasn't inspection, I mean, first, I wonder how good the lead inspection ever was at some of these facilities. Emily, I'm going to ask you what you think about that. And then secondly, we'll get to the levels question, but we're talking about millions of houses here, millions of units, aren't we?
1.6 million households with children live in federally assisted housing.
And as many of us who advocate for this, we think there ought to be twice as many units. So
that's right.
But that's, once again, that's another problem we're not going to talk about today. So once you found this, you all started reaching out for HUD.
That's correct. Well, first we actually contacted the Chicago Housing Authority because we wanted to make sure that Ms. Walker and her family were safe.
Sure.
And so we advocated with the Chicago Housing Authority to provide a reasonable accommodation under civil rights and disability law for the family and allow them to move as quickly as possible out of this unit that had been cited multiple times by the local public housing authority for lead violations and other hazardous conditions. We were able to secure an accommodation to this family, and they were quickly moved to another unit, and their lead levels have since gone down. This is not the case for the majority of families. We know of families across the country, including a woman in Maine, who, when she told the housing authority that her child had elevated blood levels ranging between 12 micrograms per deciliter to 30 micrograms per deciliter, the housing authority accused her of lying. This is going on across the country.
Now, I want you to underline this reasonable accommodation that you first introduced in the Chicago Housing Authority, because that's a tool people could potentially use right now, isn't it, if they find families around the country that are in lead or other dangerous situations?
Absolutely. It's definitely not a solution, a long-term solution.
Oh, absolutely not. But getting people away out of harm's way, so to speak, that's important, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. And the Americans with Disabilities Act, Amendments Act in 2008, redefined the definition of disability so that it now includes conditions including lead poisoning. So a child who has lead poisoning technically has a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which also amended Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which applies to all of these units. So these families have an entitlement to a reasonable accommodation in the form of expedited moving papers to a safe home.
And so when you raised that with the Chicago Housing Authority, they immediately agreed?
That's correct. They immediately agreed, and so much so that they have taken it upon themselves in advance of federal regulation to lower their definition of lead poisoning to match the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention standard.
So let's go into the difference. We're talking to Emily Benfer, who's a professor, a clinical professor of law at Loyola University in Chicago Law School, and heads a health protection clinic up there. We're talking about the problem of lead in housing right now, and there's a difference between the Center for Disease Control standards and the HUD standards. So take us by the hand and walk the listeners through that, Emily.
Right. So there are multiple issues with the current regulations that oversee federally assisted housing. This is housing that's subsidized by taxpayer dollars. Children are at risk of lead poisoning in pre-1978 homes because the regulations are first not aligned with the prevailing science or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention standards. And second, the families are held captive in the unit that poisoned their child. So with regard to the standards and the science, so the Centers for Disease Control in 2012 reduced the definition of lead poisoning that triggers action to 5 micrograms per deciliter. HUD's level is 3 to 4 times that. their definition is 15 to 19 micrograms per deciliter over 3 months, or 20 micrograms per deciliter. These are levels that cause devastating and permanent neurological harm for children.
And how did the HUD standards get so wildly different? Did they just not change in 2012? Had this been the prior standard from CDC before 2012? Or how did they get to this place?
So the standard has been evolving over the years. In 1970, the definition of lead poisoning under the Centers for Disease Control was 60 micrograms per deciliter. It went down to 40 in 1971. 30 in 1978, 25 in 1985, and then 10 in 1991. These regulations were promulgated in 1999.
Back in the last century. So finally, CDC updated a little bit, and HUD just, that's the CDC's evolution. Now, has there been a similar evolution in HUD standards or no?
No, they have not been amended since 1999 when they were first adopted.
Gotcha.
So we're operating off of antiquated policies.
Well, and there's just no excuse for that. And, of course, when you also say the science, and I would be remiss. I mean, we've interviewed Beth Butler with the Lead Safe America Foundation on Wage World last year. There's really no safe level of lead, is there?
No, there's no safe level of lead. At levels as low as 1 microgram per deciliter, there's reduced IQ. At 4, 3-year-olds are likely to be classified as learning disabled, and at 5, they're likely to fail third grade reading and math. And the issues go on from there.
And it's it's not a death sentence, but it's a life sentence. And children are especially vulnerable, aren't they?
They are. And that's in part because their bodies are still developing, and so they're absorbing the lead at much quicker rates than adults would. And it stays in their bodies forever, in their bones even. It causes severe health concerns, including biological and neurological damage that affects cognition, behavior, bodily functions, growth, and development. And it leads to academic failure, juvenile delinquency, high blood pressure, brain damage, learning disabilities, behavioral problems, developmental delay, early life expectancy, death, and so on.
I didn't hear anything good on that list.
No, nothing.
there was nothing that you could say, okay, there's a little silver. Oh, no silver lining anywhere on that. Thank you for that list. Now, if you're in your 40s, let's say, and you end up in a house with these higher HUD levels and you're in a subsidized house, is there still a danger?
Absolutely. No one is immune to the effects of lead.
Because I think that's also a common misunderstanding, is people who think, okay, I survived childhood, I probably don't have to worry about this, I shouldn't say anything to the housing authority or to my landlord, or, most people are just oblivious. In the private sector, where they might be renting or living, even owning a house, of what the lead standards might be. But this is sort of a dangerous thing for all of us, isn't it?
That's correct. Everyone should be testing their homes for evidence of lead hazards and then doing what they can to remediate those hazards to protect themselves and their family. Lead poisoning is stripping our children of their future, and we have this heightened sense, we have this heightened duty to protect them from harm like this and to give them a chance to realize their fullest potential.
So you and your allies, and they were many, civil rights organizations and others, threatened to sue HUD, but you didn't have to.
Well, we a coalition of 30 national nonprofits, civil legal aid organizations, law school clinics, scientists, public health researchers, and the list goes on, filed a petition for rulemaking demanding that HUD engage in primary prevention of lead poisoning in federally assisted housing to protect our children and their futures. We wanted them to bring the regulations into the year 2016, so align the definition of the blood lead reference value with the CDC's. And another issue that we haven't talked about yet was we asked them to update the dust and soil lead risk assessment and clearance standards, and I'd like to explain that a little bit.
Please. you're reading my mind. That was going to be the next question, but good.
Excellent. Well, as it stands, children are the proverbial canary in the coal mine. They are determining whether there is a lead hazard in the unit with their developing bodies. And this is because the current assessments do not identify lead hazards. Currently, there's an inconsistent standard across different programs. some programs only require a visual assessment before approving a unit for human inhabitancy. And that means...
Oh, and that's ridiculous.
I could tell you, I could walk into a unit and not know whether there's lead paint on the wall.
No, and believe me, I'd be walking right there with you.
And the majority of lead hazards actually come from soil and dust. And the current dust risk assessment and clearance levels are set so high that in one study, it resulted in the failure to identify 85% of housing units that cause lead poisoning at twice the CDC level. So what's happening is that these units are passing inspection, people are moving in, and then a child becomes lead poisoned, and that triggers remediation or some sort of action after the harm is already done.
And it's too late for that child. A tragedy has already happened.
Right. And then the other issue is that these families are held captive. So we had to request a reasonable accommodation to move the Walker family out of the hazardous home. But others don't have that option, that they, once a hazard is identified, they have to stay in the unit if they want to keep their federally assisted housing. So they're forced to choose between homelessness and their child's health.
You know, I live in a community in New Orleans where we don't have front yards in the older neighborhoods. And, you know, I've lived in houses 100 years old, so of course they have a history. But the era of lead paint meant that the exhaust from automobiles was essentially fumigating the neighborhood with lead, wasn't it?
That's right.
It's just one thing after another. It's not the paint, it's the cars. And now Flint, Michigan, lead pipes, this is lead pipes are ubiquitous, aren't they?
They are. They're everywhere. Our country is facing a true lead epidemic. And we have to commit our resources and all of our energies to eliminating this hazard.
And for all the publicity they're getting in Flint, the bottom line is they're still drinking bottled water up there, aren't they?
They are.
Now, there must be lead pipes in some of the old Chicago Housing Authority units.
That's correct. In fact, Michael Hawthorne has done an excellent job really reporting on this issue and demonstrating how we have millions of miles of leaded pipes around the country, and how every time construction occurs around those pipes, the lead is dispersed into the water. And while you might test your water at one point and it's lead-free, if that construction occurs the next day, your water might not be safe to drink anymore.
And there, you have to be ever vigilant. My children and I have lived, they were raised in this way, and I've certainly been here where my partner, who is very attuned to the world of lead, would tell us to screech to a stop when we were driving through various neighborhoods so that she could roll down the window and yell at people who were not doing lead-safe procedures to take paint off of the outside of houses. And you know, calling the police at the same time. This is, once you really know something about lead, this is like a full-time, you know, this is going to be an obsession. But this is wild. There's just no end to this lead problem. It's devastating. So we're talking to Emily Benfer, who's a clinical professor of law in Chicago and has been heavily involved now in trying to get lead standards that are at least better in subsidized, federally subsidized housing. Emily, what people always, whine about is the cost. And when we talk about lead pipes and public housing, we have a reduction in public housing, not an expansion. It's really one of these penny saved, pound foolish kind of, now I'm forgetting the old slogan, but it actually would cost less to deal with this problem than the long-term support in healthcare, social services, educational support, and other things. Is that just me making that up, or is that thought to be correct?
That is absolutely correct. For every $1 spent on lead poisoning prevention, we save $221. So for comparison, vaccines touted as the greatest societal cost saving, for every $1 spent is only a savings of $16.50. Lead, $1 is a savings of $221 for society. And the reason for this is lead poisoning results in $11 to $53 billion in additional healthcare costs, $165 to $233 billion in lost lifetime earnings, $25 to $35 billion in lost tax revenue, and $30 to $146 million in special education expenses. And the list goes on from there. And if you need a reason to jump on board, lead poisoning leads to criminal activity that costs society over $1.8 billion. If we can reduce the rate of lead poisoning, we can actually create safer communities and reduce the costs associated with the criminal justice system as well.
Now, I've heard a figure that where people who are already imprisoned in the criminal injustice system, the percentage of people who show some impact of lead poisoning is over half. Is that just a rumor I've heard, or is that really something you've heard as well?
I've heard that as well. It's the connection between criminal justice and lead poisoning is startling.
I mean, even if it was 10%, it'd be a horror. But, you know, the notion that it might be 50% or more. Now, where did you get this figure of 1 to 221? That is, that's something all of us need to memorize because, you know, this money argument's the one you hear. But where did that come from? Do you remember?
This is from researcher Elise Gold. She's doing some fantastic research around lead poisoning and the cost of society. I think one of the things that she actually points out that is so important to remember, lead poisoning eliminates our natural leaders. It shifts the population IQ by 5 points, which decreases the 5% of the population who are in the genius level and doubles the number of people with an IQ below 80 who qualify for special education. So if we can address lead poisoning, we can actually preserve our children's ability to reach their fullest potential.
Let's talk about what needs to be done. I know Senator Durbin and others have introduced a bill about this. Somebody has done so in the House. What's the story on that bill? Is there any way that people who are listening to Wade's World can help out?
Yes. Please contact your representatives in Congress. The Lead Safe Housing for Kids Act of 2016 was introduced last Thursday, and we are hoping that it will move forward quickly. That bill stands to make an enormous difference in the lives of millions of children by bringing the regulations into the year 2016, updating the dust and soil risk assessments and clearance standards, preventing lead poisoning in the first place by requiring risk assessments, and allowing families the right to move from the home that poisoned their children or could poison their children. And it also removes the exemption of these regulations on zero-bedroom dwelling units. Right now, if a child lives in an efficiency, they are not protected by these laws.
Crazy. And I know Senator Durbin, in introducing the bill, had a great quote in the Tribune, Chicago Tribune, that Flint is a lead issue similar to Three Mile Island was to nuclear power. But there's real prevention money in this, as well, prevention steps in this as well as the standards.
Mm-hmm. In fact, they authorized 5 years of funding to support these types of changes and more research into the issue as well to make sure that any interventions are actually addressing the root of the problem.
And is the bill the same name in the House as it is in the Senate, or do you know, Emily?
That's correct.
Okay, so I want you to ask you if you can repeat the name of that bill just so that people have it when they try to reach out.
It's the Lead Safe Housing for Kids Act of 2016. This act makes critical amendments to the federal statutes governing lead-based paint poisoning prevention.
And even in the, ruby red states of Arkansas and Louisiana and Arizona and some of the places where this show will be heard, it's still hard even for the most stiff-backed congressperson or senator that you have to be in favor of killing children, essentially, in terms of their future, and equally as importantly, use this argument that Emily has now quoted about the savings, essentially, that would be involved in finally preventing some of these lead tragedies. Emily, what else are you working on? If you're working with health, I know you're working with lead, but there must be other issues you're looking at as well.
Mm-hmm. We do a lot of work around housing conditions generally. We know that poor health is often the result of the environmental hazards commonly found in low-income neighborhoods. So we see a lot of deteriorating buildings that have lead paint crumbling off the walls as well as leaking pipes, infestations. that cause significant health outcomes for families, including respiratory distress and long-term asthma. In Florida, in fact, a judge placed 5 HUD properties in receivership for over 1,800 health and safety violations. We have this pattern of passing grades by HUD inspectors and then literally hundreds of code violations identified by city inspectors later. The problem goes well beyond federally supported housing. Countless families in the private rental market are also exposed to lead hazards and other environmental conditions issues. And they're often clustered in communities at high risk for lead poisoning and other problems.
Emily, I know you mentioned earlier this the sort of excessive lead standards in dust, but asthma has also become an epidemic in our lower income communities. Is that an issue that comes across the clinic's operations frequently?
Constantly, yes, indeed.
And is this industrially driven, or is this also something that's just ubiquitous?
In the clients that we work with and the patients of Erie Family Health Center, the root of the problem is oftentimes the home that they live in. Rodents and bug infestations often result in respiratory distress. And these are conditions that are systemic across different older housing buildings as well. I think the point is that the problem here is really complex, and all of us have a role to play if we're going to find a meaningful solution. So this means that we need all hands on deck from every profession. The government must invest in this and really dedicate themselves to protecting our children. But at the same time, when the government and local health departments fail to enforce existing regulations or they're not strong enough, we have to ensure that families with limited resources have access to law students, to civil legal aid attorneys, to really push this issue and defend their rights.
Well, and they're lucky in Chicago to have you and your operation there. Are there similar operations around the country? Because I'm not as familiar with these kinds of resources.
I think you'd love it. The American Bar Association actually requires that law schools offer experiential learning opportunities. And so there are law school clinics in law schools across the country working to really address the legal issues facing low-income populations in their communities.
Well, there you go. And Emily, if people want to follow up with you either on the question of what they can do to help on the Lead Safe Housing for Kids legislation of 2016 that, as Emily Benfer was just telling us, has now been introduced in both houses of Congress, or on this general issue. Now, you've mentioned a couple of very important things that we'll address, but one of them is certainly approaching local bar associations and law schools in your communities. They do proliferate. They may not be in some of the rural areas, but definitely they're in almost every big city. They seem to have a mandate to maybe offer some help here, too. Emily, how can people get to you or more information?
We'd love to hear from people. They could call our toll-free number, which is 800-424-4839, or email us at healthjustice@luc.edu.
I'm going to ask you to repeat both that phone number and that email address for those who are slow-hand Lukes in the audience.
To learn more about these issues or to get involved, they can contact the Health Justice Project at 800-424-4839 or email us at healthjustice@luc.edu.
We've been talking to Emily Benfer, who's the clinical professor of law at Loyola University Law School in Chicago and head of their Health Justice Project. We've been talking about lead, but she's given us a number of handles we need to remember, not only that the standards need to be next to zero in order to protect children, adults, and others, but also that if you're in subsidized housing, whether it's public housing or a Section 8, and don't be a canary in the coal fields. We need to get you out of that if there's a health issue, and that's an ADA requirement. She's also mentioned that HUD is moving forward on this, almost even in advance of the legislation. Julian Castro, claims that he's trying to work quickly on these standards. This is going to be an issue you need to follow. Thank you from Wade Rathke of Wade's World on KABF, www.kabf.org, 100,000 watts of people power broadcasting from Little Rock, Arkansas. We'll see you next Friday, 9 a.m. Central Standard Time on Wade's World. Thank you.